Okay, might make a start. Probably going to be pushing this minute out for the whole 2 and a bit hours or whatever, but let's just pretend. For those of you who are looking for the PHP talk, it's actually next door. I think you're in the wrong lecture theater. This one's AutoMake and AutoConf and things like this. Last chance to leave or not enter at all. All right. So I probably overstated this talk a little bit in the abstract. well, the bit where I gave the impression I might have a clue what I'm talking about, but you tend to sort of write out an abstract and then you chop it down a bit to make the 400-word limit, and then you go and write the talk and realize you need about 11 hours. So what I've actually decided to do is more go for an introduction to AutoMake and AutoConf. So it's probably more pitched at people, okay, you maybe build stuff from CVS, you know these things exist. I'm going to try and give you a guided tour around the various files you find in the build structure, with the idea that later on you can go and look at them and use them as examples for further work. To go much further than that, I think, would, like I said, it's probably a 3-day conference. So anyone who's looking for something more advanced than that, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to be able to fit it in. But if you want to ask me questions afterwards, that's fine too. Always willing to experiment. Okay, so like I said, it's not really, I'm going to start assuming you know that these tools exist. You maybe have them on your machine if you're building stuff out of CVS. You maybe don't have them on your machine if you're building stuff from tarballs all the time. But let's just see what they do and why it's always there. And by the way, if anyone wants to just throw up questions as I go along, quite happy to be interrupted. It's going to be pretty hard to throw me off my stride, so just sing out. And contrary to the introduction, if you want to take flash photography and get a good clear shot of the guy's head in front of you, go for it. It's not going to worry me. And your phones are off, right? Good. Okay. There's sort of, again, just to keep this talk within a day's length, I've cut down what I'm going to talk about a bit. Like, there's a lot more in this basket. The and friends part of the title is could cover pretty much everything. Oh, and sorry, just one more thing before I begin. For those of you who are thinking, oh, gee, I better madly take notes or something, I will put these slides up online at some point later on in the week. And I've put the address where I'll put the address at the end of on the last slide. So in a couple of days, you should be able to actually just download the slides, if that saves your typing at all. So I've decided to keep it just to the basic tools that you need. AutoMake, AutoConf, AutoHeader, which is the not so well-known cousin, AC Local, and Make. The particular things I've left out that you may see in a lot of packages are libtool, which is used for building shared libraries in a reasonably portable way. GetText, I don't mention, even though that tends to pop up at about this level of the build structure. Again, just for time reasons. And once you have an idea of the overall sort of picture of things, it's not too hard to work out what those tools are doing. I guess I should point out the whole reason for these tools, like this being a Linux conference, it's sort of a bit unfortunate because we don't need these tools if everyone used Linux. The reason they exist is because there are other Unix variants out there and they're mostly broken. Yes? Yeah, well, so that, I should point out, this is not a Linux-specific talk. So, like, all of my examples are done on Linux. I tend not to use too many other Unix variants, but the reason these tools exist is because people want to build software that's portable across many different platforms. So you've got problems with various levels of POSIX compliance, various functions that may not be in any particular standard that people have done their own particular implementation from, various historical oddities. And a lot of this, I can't sort of stand up here and give you hard and fast rules about here's how to make your code completely portable, because the problem is you sort of have to suck and see, and you package up your code, you send it out there, you wait till someone comes back and goes, oh, it doesn't build on VMS. And then you have to try and work out what changes to make. So there's all sorts of, but I'll try and give you a general gist of what we're trying to do here. Let's start from the end and work backwards from the bit that everyone's sort of familiar with. If you grab a tarball from somewhere, you download it, you unpack it, you basically run configure, maybe add a few options to it, --, disable bugs or something, and then run make install, maybe you run make check. People keep kind of forget this option exists. And at that point, you have the package happily installed somewhere. And if you've done this a bit, you know sort of configure takes a --, help option. There are about 6 billion things you can change, prefix for installing various options so that you can do parallel installs or whatnot. You can maybe enable certain features, disable other features. You can tell it I've actually installed my X libraries in some completely insane place, so please look over there for them. What have you. And again, a lot of this comes down to portability. If you're trying to build on two or three different platforms, you'll undoubtedly find that the X headers are in different locations, or you need to use a different linker or something because you're using Sun with GNU tools rather than the Solaris native toolset or something like that. As far as I'm concerned, this talk is about how to get up to the first step. Everything. Once you can get up to configure, it's all easy from there. So the various auto tools are how to take your source package, make it reasonably portable, and when you distribute something, you end up distributing a configure script that people can then do this sequence on. And there's an unfortunate terminology problem here. I call them the maintainer here and the developer later on. From the point of view of the person writing the software, they really want to do the minimal amount of work. They have a certain group of source files that they need to create to build their package. These are obviously including things like header files, C source files, maybe raw image files that they then convert to XPMs or 8-bit per pixel pixmaps or something like this. Maybe they've got various translation files that they then need to merge together to make properly internationalized documentation, whatever. They don't want to have to juggle more than that. Like if you're storing it in CVS or just juggling around on your home system, you really only want to have to manage the minimum number of files here. So, of course, people come up with, let's make some tools to make this all easier. And the sort of things that you don't want to have to worry about too much as a developer are, actually starting from my second point first, there's a lot of repetitive stuff in makefiles. Because if you look at a sort of standard, and by standard here I mean sort of following the GNU type conventions, for a makefile you tend to have lots of targets that are very consistent across all your makefiles. You've obviously got make to build everything, make install, make check will typically run any test and report the results. There's make dist for creating a tarball, there's make dist check for creating a tarball and then building from that tarball to see if you made a bozo error. Sometimes there's make uninstalled if you're incredibly optimistic. There's various other sort of standard targets that people expect to have, and if you don't have them there, they're going to be a little bit disappointed. And you might want to also throw in extra targets to make your life easier, like I tend to always put a snap target into make files that I do so that I can just create a daily snapshot and it builds quite happily and has the right date on it and things like that. So obviously you want tools to help automate as much of that repetitive stuff as possible because those make files can get pretty big. The other thing you want to do is postpone as long as possible the particular oddities of building on the particular system you're going to build on. Like you might be developing on a Linux system and then shipping it off to crazy people who are going to build it on Sun systems or HPACs or something like this. You don't want to have to hard code in all of the different choices you're going to make about do I build this, do I build that, what's going on, what versions of software they have. I lied before, it is actually important if you're all on Linux because no single Linux system seems to be the same. Just try and build any sort of vaguely complex package and you run into problems like what version of the free type libraries do they have, or a few years ago, what version of glibc do they have? What version of GCC? Things like what compiler flags do I pass to it? How strict do I want to get about error checking? Things like that. So a lot of the autoconf stuff particularly helps you postpone those build-specific things until the time that you're actually building stuff. The sort of details, the sort of build-specific things I'm talking about, again, give the builder the option about what sort of things they're going to put into the build. Do you want a debug-enabled build? Do you want to, I don't know, should your package be able to talk LDAP? Should it be able to talk NIS? Should it work over some other crazy protocol? All these sort of features that they might want to turn on or off, and you're not really going to make the decision for them necessarily. There's the cross-system portability problem of libraries are in different locations, they're slightly different names. You have to include different header functions. If you've ever done, write a sort of vaguely complex package that uses floating point arithmetic and try and get it to work identically on a Sun system and a Linux system, you end up having to include a whole bunch of different headers. And then you still find out you left out some tricky one and it's built anyway, but it just gives slightly wrong answers. Those sort of things are, again, you experience tells you what you need to include eventually, or else the guy who built the package tells you what you need to include. But you do need to decide those on a per build basis. And then there's the machine or the installation specific features. What compiler flags are you going to pass in? What are the particular names of the functions that are called? There's things like the wait for function on various Unix variants takes its arguments in a different order. So you have to actually test to see what it does. And some functions return slightly different things. The structure is slightly different than the return. So again, you want to test that and allow for it in your code. And yeah, of course, install locations are something you want to do at build time. All of this parsing of the config options and detecting various portability features is done by autoconf. So that's its role in the game. The next few slides are all just going through each of the tools or each of the phases of the build and what tool does what part. All this checking that autoconf does for particularly portability things and working out which version of wait for you have and what various structures contain are done by a series of macros, all written in the M4 programming language. Not the world's most pleasant language, but not too bad. You get, with autoconf, you get a very large number and an ever-increasing number of fairly standard tests for checking things like where is a particular library, where is a particular header file, does this library include this function? What else do you get? Where is the typical install paths for these things? What's the prefix on the various manual pages going to be like for this particular distribution? So you get a lot of those things coming with autoconf. It's never enough. People are always finding other things they need to test for. So various third-party macros, like developers themselves will write M4 macros to try and test for particular features they need. There's a site linked somewhere off fsf.org, which is just essentially a repository of autoconf macros for testing all sorts of various features. And people just tend to contribute macros that they come up with, and you can grab those and install them. But a lot of libraries will come with their own little collection of M4 macros that you will use when you're going to use that library. They test for various features of that library. Often, what version of the library do you have? Does it include this feature? Stuff like that. And finally, when all else fails, and it often will, you have to write your own macros. And you can just whack them in the file that produces the configure script. And okay, I'm glossing over one of the more painful details here of having to write your own macro and make it work is a bit of a time-consuming process, but I'm not going to teach M4 here. I'm not particularly enamored with it as a language, but you can, sort of the first two points here, using the built-in autoconf features and using the various third-party packages, you can probably get by sort of 80-85% of your normal everyday packaging needs. Then if your package gets really popular and starts being packaged on all sorts of white systems, you may need to test for other stuff. Or if you're doing really insane things with various protocols that vary widely, you may need to write your own macros. And the collecting together of all these different scripts, like what tends to happen is you write this script that gets run by autoconf that says, okay, do all sorts of various stuff that we'll see later. But in particular, collect together all of the M4 macros I'm going to need to run, to set up my configure script. And all of these, and the beauty is all of these M4 macros, when you make your tarball, your distribution package, get packaged with that tarball so that the end user, in this case, the person building the tarball, doesn't need to have AC local or autoconf or automake or any of these things. The whole idea is when you ship a tarball, the end user doesn't need these tools I'm talking about today. So AC local is responsible for pulling together all of the relevant macros from different places, putting them into aclocal.m4, and using that to build the package. You do a lot of these tests, and so you record the results for your code to look at later. Particularly if you're enabling or disabling features, you tend to put that in your code as a whole bunch of hash if tests in C or various other conditionals in other languages. And typically, now this is a little bit C-specific, but typically that sort of stuff ends up in a generic header file, config.h, that you will include in most of your other useful header, most of your other useful files that you want to use. And this header file that we'll see an example of later contains things like, in this build, I have a set env command. I have an unset env command. So I can happily use both of those. If your build actually detects you don't have an unset env command when you were doing config, then you have to find some way to work around that in your code. But you at least have the knowledge when you ran the configure script. You can also, as well as recording various information like that in config.h and various other files, you will want to set up things like, okay, I've finally worked out how to build a floating point thing, and I know that on a sunbox I need to include the IEEE library. But on a Linux system, I don't need to do that. I don't even have a lib IEEE there. So if I'm building on this particular system, I need to add -L IEEE to my compiler line. If I'm building on another system, leave it off because it's going to actually break the build. Or maybe you've turned on, I want warnings to be fatal, so you need to pass that in to the command line. Things like that are also managed by autoconf and automate. They construct the C flags that you're going to pass in. And finally, there's the sort of second point from the earlier slide of knowing what needs to be built. Makefiles, as I said, have a lot of repetitive targets. But at the end of the day, the maintainer needs to know, to build file foo, I need A, B, and C. And to actually get C, I need to create it by this other way. That's what you're sort of recording that automake then puts together. You basically are just recording the bare minimum. Here's, at the lowest level, you're recording the bare minimum. Here's the dependencies needed to build this package. If I need some special rule to build one of these dependencies, I can just put it in like normal make syntax. But whenever it's a fairly standard build, you just tell it literally, here's the target, here's the source dependencies, and it works out all the make file quite happily. It also knows about, and I'll get to this on the next slide, the one after, the types of files that you're building. This being important for both where do they get installed, for example, and what do you do after you've installed them. If you're installing a library, for example, you probably want to warn the user they need to run ldconfig. If you're installing a binary, there's another target that's fairly common, install-strip. So when you run that, it actually strips the debug symbols from the binaries. But it needs to know, let's try not to strip everything out of libraries because it tends to break them, and there's not really much point in stripping scripts or data files or things like that. So you tell it as you're building it up, okay, here's a data file, here's a script, here's an executable binary, things like that. That's all done in automake. Once you've collected all that information from the last few slides, and I realize I'm being a bit I'm giving you the view from 10,000 feet here before we go down a bit lower. You're at the uninteresting portion I mentioned earlier. You're now ready to, you can build up everything and the end user can just run, configure, make install, and be happy. Start reporting bugs. Here's how that all sort of goes together, because I've wobbled over the last few slides about these various information you need to collect. Most of these, if you download a package from a CVS repository or even in most tarballs, there's often a file called autogen.sh. And it can have other names, and sometimes it's called bootstrap, sometimes it's missing altogether, which crime I'll get to later on. But it tends to run essentially what I put up here. Runs AT local, collects together all of the M4 macros, runs auto header, which scans your configure.in file, which is the thing that autoconf ultimately runs, works out what variables are you, what functions are you going to be testing for in libraries. So what variables am I eventually going to have to hash define in config.h for a C program? So auto header builds up this template file. Auto make then again builds up a prototype make file. It doesn't quite get build up the make file. Automake takes a file that's typically called makefile.am and produces a file called makefile.in. Later on, configure turns makefile.in into makefile. So makefile.in is the thing you're shipping. The add missing here is one of the fairly common flags to automake that sucks in various scripts, such as a script for an install script that has been written over a number of years to be portable across any number of different architectures and operating systems, and will somehow work out how to install programs on your machine. On Linux, it just runs install. On various other operating systems, it does all sorts of black magic. And a lot of these things are actually written in shell. Some of them are written in Perl, but a lot of them are written in shell. And in shell, that if you look at it, you think it's way verbose. It's like a first year university shell script or something. But what they're actually doing is writing incredibly portable shell that will run across every known variant of essentially born shell compatible shell. Yes? Yeah, well, it's for the auto tools, it's born shell compatible, not bash compatible. There's quite a good book on auto make, auto conf, auto, etc. Euphemistically, the goat book, which is published by New Writers, that's written by Tom Tromey is one of them. I can't think who the other two are. Basically, three of the five people who helped write most the bulk of these tools, and who now help maintain it. And there's two chapters essentially in there. I don't know if they realized they were writing a second chapter later on, talking about portable shell programming and giving all sorts of traps of things that you want to commonly write in bash that works on every system you've ever come across but doesn't work on a 10-year-old Sunos box or something. So the only requirement is born shell, not bash. It's actually quite reasonable, and I've tried this experiment of you link bin shirt to ash and run it there. That tends to break things that you've forgotten about. And then finally, we run autoconf after we've built up all these templates. That takes the configure.in and the various other files and pulls them all together, creates a configure script, which again is a highly portable shell script, creates various makefile.in files in all your different subdirectories, and packages it up so that we're ready for the user to run the uninteresting bits, configure and make install and so on. I've cheated here. I've sort of assumed you have all of these tools. If you actually look at a real autogen.sh, you tend to find that there's about 100 lines of shellcode initially testing for the existence of these various programs, testing for the right versions of these various programs, all sorts of things like this. I've also cheated, I just realized, there's no such program as AutoMake anymore. Recently, they re-released AutoMake 1.4, and the binary is now called AutoMake-1.4, and the binary for AutoMake 1.6 is called AutoMake-1.6, and so on. It used to be, slight historical lesson for a minute, AutoMake 1.4 came out 1999, I think. there was about a 2-year gap till AutoMate 1.5 came out. And it was becoming sort of the legendary software release because it was going to have all these features that fixed up all of the annoyances in AutoMate 1.4. In which time, a lot of people like myself who learnt this thing in that intervening 2-year period just learnt to work around all these problems. So AutoMate 1.5 came out and we weren't so keen about upgrading because AutoMate 1.5 got skipped over pretty quickly. 1.6 is not entirely backwards compatible. Your AutoMate 1.4 scripts will not run necessarily with AutoMate 1.6, so you sort of have to make the decision about what version of AutoMate you're running. And so they re-released AutoMate 1.4 with the -1.4 suffix on the AutoMate name, just so that people wouldn't sit there and run AutoMate. You need to be able to detect the version, basically. And I think the poor maintainers were thinking, we're finally rid of AutoMate 1.4, it's 2 years ago, and Havik Pennington put a bit of pressure on Tom Tromey and got him to re-release 1.4. Not sure if there were standover tactics done at the office or whatever, but he basically put out this version with the adjusted binary. Okay, the other side of the coin. You've somehow magically gone through all this work, produced all these nice scripts, and package something up so that your user can do the magical sequence. Now it's time to be nice to the user, and by the user I mean here, the person who downloads your tarball and wants to build it. You've possibly spent hours sweating blood trying to get various tools to work, and you've juggled get text versions which are hopelessly incompatible, and you've managed to get the right auto make on your system, and you've got DocBook set up so that it actually typesets the document in some sort of vaguely correct character set, and so on. A lot of people wanting to build this software don't have all that stuff. So developers have to, and you want to walk the fine line. You don't want to ship the binary, obviously, because then it takes all the fun out of building it, and it's not particularly portable. But you may want to ship files that are not going to be unportable, but you yourself will generate them because they change from version to version. So within any given tarball, they're always going to use the same icon on every single version of every single platform you're building on. But between version to version, that icon may change. So on your side, on the developer side, you'll have makefile rules to build that icon. But you may very well just ship the final image to your end users, just to get around this problem that this saves them having to have the tools. The tools may be difficult to install. They may be very time-consuming to run. If you've got even a vaguely slow system doing things like merging all of the localization files into the message catalog, can take quite a long time on big packages where you've got hundreds of messages. So there's a few examples there of the things people are shipping. The last one, for example, is a type of thing that's going to be portable across all the interesting architectures that use these packaging schemes, but will change from version to version. You, in an RPM spec file, you have the version number. So when you make a new release, the version number in the spec file goes up by one. So on the developer side, you will often be building that spec file in your AutoConf and AutoMake script. But when you ship it, you might as well just ship the final spec file with the right version number intact. And it's a bit of a fine line sometimes about what do you ship and what do you build. And it often comes down to how easy is it to get the tools that the people need to build this stuff, how easy is it to run them. Yep? Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And at the same time, though, you're allowed to assume certain things. Like, you can probably assume they have a C compiler. You can assume they have a shell, things like that. But yeah, if it's a vaguely lineball call, then by all means, think about giving them the option to turn this thing off. Don't build the documentation necessarily, or maybe don't make the fancy splash screen if it requires some special package. This, of course, leads to endless religious arguments. As so many of these things do, distributing the built files is a waste of time. users can just get the packages, you manage to do it for heaven's sake, why can't they? It increases the size of the download, blah, blah, blah. The other side of the coin is what I just said on the last slide. Be sort of pseudo nice to your users. They're going to have to do some of the work because they're willing to build from source, but if you can make their life easier by, say, generating a spec file or the deb rules or an image maybe, something like that. Quite common, as I said, is people they will distribute the .gmo files, the merged translation catalogs, with tarballs, so that the end user doesn't need to have a completely working get text install. The problem is, you sort of want to be nice to your users the other way too. What if they want to develop, what if they want to send you a patch or something? They probably want to try and build it the same way you built it. So you also want to ship the autogen.shirt file, the various config.in, makefile.am, stuff like that, because that gives them the chance to go back a step from configure, go back to running autoconf, AC local, stuff like that, and run these files. That tends to be the nice way to do things. There is a school of thought, and I don't want to sort of stereotype anyone, but particularly very hardline GNU packages tend to have this school of thought a bit, that you have this script, and they tend to call it Bootstrap, that will run AC local, auto header, auto make, auto conf, and won't package it. So you get the final thing, you've got the configure script, make install, stuff like that, but you don't actually have all the stuff to go back to the start. If you want to go back to the start and rebuild from scratch, you've got to do a CVS checkout. I'm not entirely convinced of the benefit of that argument. They're claiming they're saving a few bytes, but I'm not so sure that's worth the trade-off these days. Okay. So that was the view from 10,000 feet of what on earth is going on here, how we pull all these bits together and why. And we're going way too fast. Okay. Anyone wants to just like make up some questions to kill time? Please, by all means, go for it. Yes. How does the last? Well, because they are distributing. So the question was, how does this not necessarily distributing all of your sources go with the GPL? The first thing is, they're the guys writing the code, so they can distribute whatever they want. The GPL applies to your redistribution. The second thing is you actually have all of the tools required to build the package. Like, you have all of the source. You just don't necessarily have the source one step back. So, yeah. And you can, the source is available usually from, like, particularly in the GNU things, you can go and grab CVS repositories or things like that. It's not too painful. But like I said, they're the guys who wrote the code, so they can distribute whatever the heck they like, right? It's the nice thing about being the copyright holder. Anyone else before we move on? We're plunging sharply now, right? No more 10,000 feet. Hold on, we might just make this look more scary. Is that still readable from the back? Cool, okay. Kind of designed to fit on one screen. It's readable from the front. Don't go telling me you can't see it. for the slides, sorry? What do you mean? Do I use to make the slides? Yeah, Vi and DocBook and a DocBook slide package. A little bump in the road here. I just thought I'd throw in what a real automake script looks like. We're again working backwards. In real life, the configure script is used, config.in is used in conjunction with makefile.am to generate various things. So you tend to work from configure to makefile to makefile.am to makefile and so on. I'm kind of going backwards because I'm assuming you have some knowledge of how a makefile vaguely works. And I'm not assuming too much here. If you don't really use makefiles too much, don't worry, I'll explain things as we go. But I'm working backwards. I'm showing how the step before the makefile looks a bit like this. The key things here are the first line tells it what follows are scripts. Basically, install them as executables. Don't bother trying to strip them. And they get installed in the binder for this package. So it might be user bin or user local bin or whatever. Prefix slash bin is where these are going to be installed. And this is actually the makefile.am from GTK doc package. And I selected it because it doesn't have binaries involved too much. The packages that tend to have binaries involved, as we'll see later, are much more complex and will fit on one slide. So we're a bit restricted. Oh, and I've also, let's point this out now, anywhere you see three dots in these slides, that's the excuse for it didn't fit on the slide, so I just chopped out some bits that weren't really relevant. There are about another, in this bin scripts, there are about another 10 scripts that get packaged here, and in a bit lower down in the GTK doc data, underscore data thing, there's another dozen files there that get packaged. Moving down, after bin scripts, GTK doc data dev just says, here's where I want you to install the data, not in prefix slash, typically data is prefix slash share, put it in prefix slash share slash GTK doc and make it easier to pronounce. And data is typically architecture independent. Remember, user share and whatnot can be shared across different operating systems. And then here's various data files, gtk.common.pl, gtk.xsl, and so on. Just install them. Data files just get installed verbatim. No transformations, no stripping, no nothing. Package config is a little extra tool that mostly used in the GNOME project, may wander outside on occasion, just used to juggle dependencies between packages. Yet another way to do that. But the whole idea is a package will install a little file that says, here's what you need to build me, here's the various C flags, here's the libraries I need to be linked against for this particular architecture, and here's the packages I also depend on. So that's just installing its rubbish there. Extradist is sort of an interesting target. You get a whole bunch of files that don't make files, automate can't work out that you need them. Things like the README file, the maintainers file, the authors file, news, any spec file, things like that. Anything you need to build the software, AutoMake will know about because it goes, wait a minute, I've got a dependency on that somewhere, I better package it. But there's other files that you never use in the build process, but you want to ship them. Maybe various text files, commonly various text files, maybe an icon file that doesn't get built, you've just created it and dumped it in there. They go in extra dist. And they, you still need to put special rules in the makefile for how to install these or what to do with them. And sometimes you don't want to do anything with them. You just want to ship them so that someone who's got the tarball has a copy of the license, has a copy of the changelog, things like this. But you may want to subsequently install them in user share doc, whatever. So extradist just says, here's a whole bunch of junk. And here's an example. I had a pointer. The second line under extradist, gta.doc.pc.in, is an example of what I was talking about earlier. That file is used by configure autoconf to generate gtkdoc.pc. It's not generated by makefile, so automake and autoconf don't actually know it needs to package that file. But at the same time, the package maintainer is saying, I'll ship you this file, the sort of template for gtkdoc.pc, so that if you want to rebuild the package, you've got the information there you need. In this case, if you'd forgotten to package that in extra dist, when you did make dist check just before shipping a tarball, which you always do, right, it would notice that it can't build, it has no way to build gtkdoc.pc and it needs it and it doesn't have it and lots of whining ensues. So that one you would know. Maintainers you wouldn't know because you never need it. Finally, down the bottom there is a sort of hint of what's to come. Like I said earlier, AutoMake by default will generate various targets, including the make dist target, which simply generates, bundles up all of the things you need to build the package in source form and creates a tarball and gives it an appropriate name, package name dash version number dot tar dot gz. You can do various twiddling with AutoMake and AutoConf to make it generate dzip files and blah, blah, blah. But by default, you get tar.gz files. You may want to do, again, there may be things that AutoMake doesn't know about that you want it to do before creating the tarball. In this case, it's saying, when you're creating the distribution, I want you to make a doc directory. I want you to copy over all of the source documentation into there. Get rid of any CVS directory, because we don't want to pretend like we're a CVS repository here. And do similar things with the DB to man directory. Because those two directories contain just contain static files, so they're not being built. So again, AutoMake doesn't know they exist. That's the sort of thing where you initially will write a makefile.am and you won't put that in, and you'll make this check, all happily works, and then you go, okay, let's pretend I'm a user and try and build it. I don't seem to have any documentation. So you go back and you work out, all right, didn't package the documentation, need to add this little hook in there. AutoMake is kind of cool like this. They've added in, for various targets, you can put in the dash hook version of that target, sort of similar to what Emacs does in various situations. And it runs that after it's run the target, just before it finishes up. There's an install hook as well that does a similar kind of job. Now, yes? In this slide? This one? Right. It just the make stops because it's just a fatal error inside the make file, so it'll stop building. But the whole logic here is distr. I haven't quite got to what distr and sourcedir are here. Sourcedir is a special variable that refers to the current directory. Distr is the directory it's doing the make dist in, which is a separate directory. And you have to remember, when you're doing all of this stuff, you have to design things with a view to sourcedir and destinationdir are not the same. Like, you can be building somewhere separate from the source directory. So you don't go doing foolish things like using current directory. So in this case, distr is a directory that the build process itself has created. It's got complete control over the permissions. The sort of thing that can go wrong is you run out of space. In which case, a fatal error is not a complete disaster. There's not much else that can go wrong in that case. You need to be a bit more careful on install targets, for example, where you may not have permissions to install in various places, stuff like that. But when you're creating the distribution tarball, you've got complete control. AutoMake has complete control over what it's doing. Does that sort of answer your question? Yep. Yes. Okay, so the question was for package config stuff, is there a script that goes in bin for that? The way package config works is you've already installed a package config package, which is really just one of these third-party macros I was talking about earlier. It's something that you run an M4, little M4 script inside your config.in, and you say, I require, my package that I'm building requires GTK doc. And you ask package config to tell you the information about GTK doc, and it comes back and it goes, okay, I've got GTK doc version 0.10 or something. It requires these flags if you're going to build it, if you're going to include me. It requires these flags for C flags. It requires these flags for linkers. So this is purely just a data file in this case. There may be other ones that do require a script to be installed somewhere. Yeah, a bin scripts or a bin program, which is the target I'll get to in a minute. Yes, essentially everything. The first line on this example is probably one of the more important and common things. It's saying, here are all the programs I'm building that are going to end up in user bin or user local bin or whatever, right? Every program I'm building, I want to also tell AutoMake, by the way, that I want you to build this program, but don't install it. And in that case, bin would be replaced with no inst. Here, and it's saying, here's some scripts I want you to build, here's some programs I want you to build. I need them for other things in my build process. Maybe I need them for testing, maybe I need them to build other source files or whatever. But don't worry that I don't install them. And I don't want you to install them because they're pointless outside of this build process. What do you mean by targets here? Yes. The bin, yes. these names, anything before the equal sign up there has special meaning. And we're sort of going to get to this in the next page, but it's almost always of the form something underscore something else. The second something else we'll get to on the next slide. The first something is either the program that you're building or where it's going to be installed, depending on the context. Like in this case, it's saying these are scripts that get installed in the bin dir. You can also have scripts that get installed in the header dir if you're completely mad, or scripts that might get installed in some other dir. And we see lower down where we've made GTK doc. So rather than just saying, so we're saying on the line below that, these are data files and I want you to install them in GTK doc data dir. Right, okay. Okay, maybe I need to explain this a bit better. There's actually no autoconf magic at all in this particular file. So let me explain it. Let me maybe say how AutoMake would go through this file and process it, okay? And let's do it without looking. Excuse me. Yes. And unfortunately, this is sort of a little bit of a problem because we're not doing the 11-hour version of this talk. I can't give everything. Like, there is quite thick books about this, but I will... Okay, I'll definitely try and explain this because this is a little bit important. When AutoMake runs through this file, there's no autoconf magic here at all. We'll see later on there's some that need to depend on autoconf, but this is not at all dependent. It looks at the first line, it goes, okay, here are, coming up are a list of programs that are going to be installed in user bin, in the bin dir, whatever you've set that to, like traditionally it's prefix slash bin, where you've gone minus minus prefix to configure later on, and they're scripts. By being scripts just tells it, I want you to install them as executables, and don't bother trying to strip them if they're running the make install dash strip target. And then there's a list of names. So in the make file later on, it has, here are various targets I need to generate. And it will loop through all of those. It looks later on in the file, and we'll get to this, either in this particular case, these scripts already exist in the source distribution. It doesn't have to build them, it just has to know to install them. Later on, we'll get to a case where it has to actually do some work to build these things that it wants to install. And I'll show you how to specify the various dependencies. But in this case, AutoMake just goes, okay, I've got these things, I just have to install them. Then it says, all right, we're now hitting a... and here is a little bit of magic. We've got some word ending in dir. So GTK doc data dir. I'm telling it a special directory that I'm going to use later. Whenever I use GTK doc data, the bit without the dir on the end, I want you to use that directory that I'm telling you here to as the base instead of whatever normal base directory you would use. So this means on the next line when it's installing GTK doc, these data files in GTK doc data, instead of installing them in the normal data directory, install them in the data directory slash GTK doc. Okay? Yes, it does. Yes, all those underscore capital letter things on the end are on the next slide. But they all mean, like, data files, install them verbatim. I think I've lost the microphone. Ooh, we're back. And we do... Okay, no, it's not coming through, is it? No, maybe I've done something perfect. Hello? No, it's slipped. Is this better? Whoop. Oh. I think it was up as high as it went. Okay, we'll see how we go. Again, we have a similar line on the next line. Package config dir. It's saying put it in the libdir, which is traditionally prefix slash lib slash package config. And here's a data file I want you to install in that directory. Again, data files just get installed verbatim. Nothing magic happens to them. They don't get stripped and so on. The extra disk target, when it gets to that, no build requirements here. This is just purely a packaging requirement. When you create the tarball, put in all of these files. It doesn't care. So that's just in the make disk target. It just says, here's a whole bunch of files I just need to copy into the tarball. Finally, there's this extra little rule down here that it knows when I'm creating the make disk target, the last thing I do before tarring everything up is I run, if it exists, I run the dist hook target. And here's the dist hook target that it runs. And everything below that is just pure make file, gets copied verbatim into the make file. So any typos you make there end up in your make file. Yes? After the dist, but not totally after this. It runs make dist in that it builds all of the source files that you might need. It puts everything in a directory. It's just about to tar it and gzip it, and then it runs dist hook, and then finally it tars and gzips. Okay, so it's basically your last chance to copy over files that wouldn't otherwise get in there, like in this case, whole directories. And I must say, you can do all sorts of evil things here. As I'll get to later, like the dist check rule has certain requirements that it has to work when the source directory is read-only. So it creates, it actually runs through and makes dist and then unpacks it and makes that all read-only and then tries to build it. Unfortunately, there are some tools that want to poke around in your source directory. Particularly in the GNOME project, we have about 3 of them at the moment. And so everyone makes a little, not a dist hook rule, but a little build rule that just runs through and quietly makes the source directory read-write again so that these other tools can do their stuff. So it's not going to, it sort of automate comes with nice safety-conscious features, but it doesn't actually stop you shooting yourself in the foot if you want to. You can just override everything. But that's sort of levels of black magic that you don't normally need to do. So is that a bit clearer now that we've run through that? Okay. This slide just gives you an idea of the various special types of files, and these are most of them that Automake really cares about. Data files just go in verbatim. If you tag something, the foo that I put at the beginning here, that's just because there has to be something before the underscore. The interesting bit here is what is the bit in capital letters after the underscore, which gives you the type of the file. Data files just go in verbatim. Headers are basically data files, except they can do a little bit more sanity checking on them, and I can't for the life of me remember what it does at the moment, but it also knows that if you don't do anything special, it really wants to put that in the include directory, like user include package name or something like that typically. And you will only, you don't label all of your header files as underscore headers data type. You generally only label the ones that you're going to install when the package has been built. So if all of your header files are just for internal building purposes, you don't worry about them. They're just normal source files. It's the things that end users of your built package might want to use. If you're building a library with header files, things like that. Programs is fairly common. Executable binaries, yes? Yes, how the file should maybe be installed. Various options like the install dash strip one. Programs can be stripped, scripts don't. Scripts and programs get installed executable. Headers that does this tiny little bit of sanity checking. Libraries that uses a different tool to build them. It may have to use libtool to build them, things like this. So it's clues mostly to the install and uninstall process. And in the case of libraries, it's actually a bit of a hint to the build process as well. That's pretty close to the whole bunch there. As far as end targets are concerned, which is enough. Like, there's not too many other things. Every now and again, you get the feeling you really kind of like another program type, but you just have to get by. There's a question just next to you. Yes? In the info files for AutoMake, like they're just in the various, do you mean where are the programmatic rules or where's the documentation? Sorry? No, all of AutoMake is a shell script. And it's actually inside the shell script there. But you can actually see what's going on in the final make file that gets generated. After you run AutoMake and after you run configure, you get a make file and it will have one line of targets are here are my programs. And then later on you look where the program, it loops over the programs variable in its make file. And you can see that when it installs them in the install strip, it tries to strip them. Whereas when it loops over the scripts variable, it doesn't try to strip them and things like that. So you can see it in a few places inside AutoMake, inside the final make file, and it's all in their documentation, in the info files and things like that as well. Like these particular things I just ripped out of the info files. Yes? Yes. Yes. Sorry, just for the people who can't hear, maybe this all goes in a file typically called makefile.am. The AM standing for AutoMake. AutoMake processes that and produces a file makefile.im. And then we get to the next part of the question. It tends to actually work backwards. Makefile, when you run AutoMake, it scans AutoConf to work out if there's anything special it needs to include. Nothing here that step would do nothing in this particular example. And actually the production of makefile.in is done by AutoConf. They're right at the end of AutoConf, which we'll get to after the break, it actually says output these various makefile.in files. Those makefile.in files then get shipped with the tarball, and when someone runs the configure script on the machine they're going to build on, configure turns makefile.in into makefile. So this is sort of a twice removed template, if you like. AutoMake changes some of the variables into concrete things and leaves certain other things still as variables, things like locations of various header files, the flags that you're going to pass to the compiler, all those build specific features I mentioned earlier are still open for debate in the makefile.in. The configure script then puts concrete values onto all of these things and produces the makefile. I should point out too, all of these scripts, AutoMake, AutoConf, partly because I guess they're GNU style tools, they generate very correct, for want of a better word, makefiles in that the makefile you get at the end, you still can do customization things on it. Like you can still happily pass in C flags equals minus W all or something like that. You can still, you won't be overriding anything in the makefile where it's talking about its own C flags that AutoMake's generated. It's using a different variable and it then combines that with the C flags that it knows C flags is a user variable that can be passed in on the command line. It combines that with its own internal C flags that configures pass through and makes the ultimate C flags that it passes in. It still allows you to relocate packages right at the very end. Like you can pass in, a lot of GNU makefiles have a dest dir variable that you can set for installing it in some completely wacko location that you didn't configure it for. Commonly used if you, for example, have a big network and on the server all these programs are installed under, say, /u1/user/local whatever, and that's then NFS mounted as user local on all the workstations. So you configure it for user local, but you actually install it under U1 user local on the server, things like that. So they generate makefiles that right up to the very end, you've got as much control as you've ever wanted from a makefile, which tends to mean these makefiles are not particularly readable. Like they make sense, but they're very, very generic. There's variables all over the ship. You read through sort of lines and lines of setting variables until you get down to the target, at which point you've forgotten what the variable was that earlier on, which sort of explains the programmer's love of working with this, a file that's literally only this long. Like I realize I've chopped out bits here, but it's really much simpler at this level than the final makefile you get. Sort of why these tools exist. So just moving along, the only other target I haven't really covered here, man and tech infos. Again, the GNU history is showing here, apparently all real documentation is in TechInfo format. Yeah, well, doesn't have an HTML target or anything like this, right? But it does know things like the man target does know things about how manuals are arranged in the sections, because not all of your man pages end .3 that end up in man section. They could be 3N or 3Q or thing, weird sort of things like this, and it knows to install them in the right section. Yes? Sorry, which one? Ah, yes, you're right. It's Foo Man, isn't it? Not Foo Man. Yeah, it's talking about the collection of manual pages. All of these things tend to be plural for file types. Sounds like an overqualified audience member, actually. You sure you're in the right shoot? Right. Dangerous person to have. And the libraries and LT libraries file types at the end are essentially the same, except LT libraries is a hint that this library is going to be built with libtool, something I'm carefully not covering here. Libtool is a tool for building, again, building shared libraries on any number of platforms. And if you've tried to build shared libraries by hand on various platforms, you realize why this tool exists, because on some platforms you have to relink it once you've installed it in a different location. On Linux, you can just happily copy around the .so file. So again, we wouldn't need libtool if we all use Linux. Whereas on HPUX, for example, and maybe even on Solaris, you have to relink the library essentially once you've dumped it in the right location so that the internal things point correctly. And libtool, the beauty of all this is libtool knows all that. So for the programmer, you just happily do all the libtool incantations in it, and then when it comes to make install time, it knows what to do on the right platform, because part of the configure script is detecting what platform you're running on. And again, all these scripts are built up, auto-make, auto-conf, etc., with an enormous knowledge of different platforms. Now we're going better. Okay. Here's the sort of generic example of a C program, for example, but it need not all of this is specific to C. In fact, very little of it is specific to C or C++ or anything like this. This could just as easily be how to build these slides. I need to have a couple of input files to generate them. So I wouldn't call it a program, I'd end up calling it a data, but to the first line, I'm building a program called Bug Buddy. It's taken from a real life example from someone who I actually trust to get it right. So it's building a program called Bug Buddy, so it's an executable, it's a binary, can be stripped, blah, blah, blah. It's going to install it in the binder. The next line says, to build Bug Buddy, here are the sources. Now, you may notice on the first line, Bug Buddy has a hyphen, on the second line, Bug Buddy has an underscore. This is basically, they use what they call the generic name of these things, which is turn all hyphens into underscores, turn all dots into underscores, basically turn all special characters into underscores. So if this was called bugbuddy.la, the name on the next line would be bug underscore buddy underscore la underscore file type, sources in this case. There could be more than one thing in the bin programs line, like I could be building bug buddy and bug foo and bug bar, and then later on I'd have bug foo sources and bug bar sources. And this is just saying, one program at a time, here's all the things I need to build Bug Buddy. There is one variable in that list, this BB built sources, which sort of hints that maybe that's sources that get built for Bug Buddy rather than existing. The guy who wrote this is sane and actually wants his package to be maintained, so he uses good variable names. This is from later on in the same makefile, .am. He says, okay, this back here, sorry, I'm just going back one page a minute. Back here, we just, as part of the sources for building Bug Buddy, we need to have the contents of this BB built sources variable. The BB built sources variable consists of two files, bbmarshall.c and bbmarshall.h. These are data marshallers, essentially data conversion functions that are used in GTK and glib a fair bit. And so to create these files, they're auto-generated from a template. again, just cutting out most of the scud work. To generate these files, he just says, okay, to build bbmarshall.h, I need this .list file from the source directory. And then there's just magic commands. Normal makefile commands at this point. They run a particular script that with a minus h option that produces a header file. The next line does the same thing with a minus c option to produce a c file. Fairly uninteresting, the dot, dot, dots that I cut out. The last two lines with their dot, dot, dots are just normal makefile fragments. AutoMake has the fallback that when it sees something that it doesn't know, it can't treat it specially. So basically, it's not a something underscore something equals type line. It just copies it verbatim into the final makefile, well, into makefile.in and ultimately into makefile. So like I said, all your typos happily end up in the makefile at the end. Something's behaving strangely, just grep for the weird thing you put in the makefile and you'll realize it didn't get converted. Yes? Into the sources list, yes. Yes, you could very easily put them earlier. You can factor things how you like inside the makefile.am to suit yourself. In this case, the bug buddy makefile is simple enough, he definitely could have done that. But he's sort of following a pattern that's in bigger programs, you start to actually appreciate, I pull my built sources over on one side and I put everything else in another list. That sort of makes life a bit easier. Because also you can use, again, these are makefile, normal makefile rules, so you can use pattern matching, for example, for those who are happy hacking away at makefiles. Like you could say, to generate bb-star.h, here's the thing I do. And if I have a whole bunch of built files, bb-marshall, bb-general, whatever, I can generate them all that way. So yeah, it's purely a choice mechanism here. It's not compulsory. There was a question over here somewhere? Yes. Yeah, it's all one line. AutoMake and AutoConf operate like make in that it really expects to just see a single line. So if you're going to break it, you have to put backslash at the end. It's like if you're doing a make rule, everything here that's the dot, 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 technically has to be all one line. If you put a return in the middle, things go very, very wonky very quickly. But it actually starts building it in a separate shell for make file rules. In this case, it wants BB built sources to be a list of words. And so the slashes is just purely a formatting convenience here. And again, we're using SourceDir because BuildDir and SourceDir may not be the same. I'm going to go more to the sort of just showing you a bunch of examples now that might continue to clarify a little bit what's going on, because it really is hard to just run through all the enumerations and fairly boring. Here's a real life makefile. Typical projects, there's a few different ways to organize your source code. I don't want to sort of teach anyone to suck eggs here, but a fairly common way is you have the top level directory contains things like the change log, the various text files, licenses, news, maintainers, blah, blah, blah. Maybe spec files. There might be a subdirectory for the Debian build rules. Possibly a subdirectory for the documentation. The sources in another subdirectory. You sort of split things up so the top directory doesn't look too crowded. This isn't universally true or compulsory. However, apparently the PowerPoint isn't on. Excuse me. Could have got embarrassing. But you see packages where they haven't sort of followed this tradition and they've just dumped all of their .c and .h files in the top level directory, and it does take a bit of hunting through to find out is there a README file, whatever. So let's assume a sort of tree structure for our source code, which I've done here. You need to tell AutoMake that you've got other subdirectories it should go into, because it doesn't necessarily have to go into all your subdirectories. You may just have some there that are various garbage, like you don't want to go into CVS subdirectories, for example. So the subdirs line tells it, here are subdirectories I'd like you to go into. In this case, go into libsmile, DTD, and PO. And as I've added a note at the bottom there, and then build the current directory, the top level one. By default, it builds dot last. Not usually a problem, but every now and again you find that, oh, I need to build something in the top level directory first. And so you can just put dot at the beginning or something like that. We see the extra dist target here again, whole bunch of things. In this case, distribute the RPM spec file, distribute the template for creating the spec file on the grounds of let the user build everything from scratch, and distribute various functions that are used by Intel tool, which is for merging translations into various text files. Finally, again, we have a rule that doesn't look like any sort of auto make construct, so it's just something that gets copied verbatim into the make file, and you can just ignore it, except it fit it on one slide, so I didn't replace it with dot, dot, dot. But it just creates a snapshot target and does various magic required so the RPM spec file works on the tarball. You just need to change the name of the package. So, yes? Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, sorry. Both AutoMake and AutoConf, you tell it, here are the subdirectories I want you to go into. And so it goes, okay, look for makefile.ims in each of these subdirectories, use them to produce makefile.ims. The configure script at the end then knows when it's processing makefile.im that contains the subdirectories to descend into and so on. Yes? Yeah, okay, there's poor programming technique and good programming technique conflicting there. I want it all on one line so that it all runs in a single incantation of the shell. If you put them on multiple lines, make runs them in separate shells, which can be a problem when you do make minus J2 or something, because these lines have to be executed one after the other. I can't have one being executed, because they operate on the same file and things like this, and it doesn't know the dependencies. It could potentially put, I don't know, make minus J won't, but it could, you could get a race condition on an SMP box just because it can start up the separate shells on separate CPUs. For the same target? Not so? Oh, okay. Pardon? All right, okay, silent. But yes, you're right. It's completely dodgy programming in that I'm not testing the exit command of any... Yes. Well, the other sort of logic here is I have pretty much complete control over what's going on here. Again, the only thing that's going to bite me is I run out of disk space, at which point exploding is fairly acceptable. Because I'm talking about a file that is within the complete control of the package at this point. But yeah, you're right. Putting them on separate lines or testing exit codes between them or something. Pardon? Right. Sorry, was there anything back here that was special? No. All right. Yes? Yeah. Yes. You may just use, the question was, is putting things in extra disk equivalent to copying them over as part of, say, the disk hook rule? And the answer is yes. The reason you might use the disk hook rule instead of extra disk is if, for example, as in one of the earlier examples, we wanted to copy the contents of a whole directory and don't actually want to care about keeping track of all the extra files in that directory. The problem is in extra disk, you've got to list all the files one at a time. So if you can do it at all algorithmically, you may want to use disk hook. This example demonstrates two things. With no explanation whatsoever. All right, it actually demonstrates three things. it's leading into the AutoConf section of the talk. The first line, I'll just say, take it on trust. We're getting to that in a little bit. But it's essentially an example, this libglade cflags variable that's substituting in there is something that AutoConf works out the value of this. It works out what cflags you need to build libglade. And it adds that to the includes line. Includes, again, is a special word to automake, which says, I want you to put this in the minus capital I, well, in, I want you to put this on the command line of any compiler invocations you do. So if libglade cflags is like minus I user local foo, then every time it tries to build a program, we get minus I user local foo on that line. There's also lines like ldadd, which are things that get passed to the linker all the time. The next, well, second line's blank, the third line's a comment. Line is a special thing that was actually only added in a recent automake. I should point out the gentleman, James Hentridge, who maintains libglade, is a big believer in bleeding edge software. So I think libglade, automake 1.6 had sort of hit the streets for about 3 minutes before it was being used in libglade, and he found that there were quite a number of bugs, to be fair. This is a way that in earlier versions of automake you had to sort of hack around. If you wanted to pass special flags to configure for the disk check that you wouldn't normally pass in, because when we get to configure we'll see there are, you can set up everything with default options. But if you're saying, when you run disk check, I absolutely want you to build the documentation, for example, which is what this one's saying. If you run by default with libglade, if you run configure, it doesn't build the documentation, because that's one of those, it's painful to build and they may not have the tools. When you're running disk check, though, I want you to build the documentation, because I have the tools and I want to check that it really can be built and I haven't messed it up. So, special instruction to automake, here's a flag to pass configure. It may only be in automate 1.7. I'm not sure if it's in 1.6. Like, James is really bleeding edge here. Yes? Okay, can you, so the question, assigning things to bin scripts, essentially. The first time you can use equals, later on you can use plus equals to append to it. In automake 1.4, you could happily use plus equals, you could happily append to bin scripts even if it didn't exist previously. Automake 1.6 has a bit of a whine about that. I think automake 1.7 may just break. So you do have to be a little bit careful that if you're going to be appending to it inside conditionals that you've actually assigned to it first. That's one of those examples of not all automake 1.4 scripts work in 1.6. So you do have to, at some point, check that you're using the right version of automake, which is why calling it just automake is no longer an appropriate thing. And so this one, yes, there's a bit of a conditional going on here. If the configure script defines the variable have Python, which is a test it can do, do we have a suitable version of Python available, then build this libglade convert script. Early versions did not have that conditional, and there was much angst in the community because it wasn't building. The package config stuff, fairly boring, we've seen that before. The last stuff, the last section again, is sort of an example of another hook that you can put in yourself. He's created some documentation here, and in fact he's created a DTD for libglade. It's libglade, for those who don't know, is a tool for taking an XML description of a GUI and turning it into a bunch of GTK widgets that then display on your screen. So you can use a program, surprisingly enough, called Glade to create your GUI. It then writes out an XML file, or you can create it by the XML file by hand. Libglade then reads in that file and throws you back a whole bunch of GTK widgets that you can then display on your screen. Cool stuff when it works. Libglade 2.0, they came up with this idea of stop producing illegal XML files and start using a DTD. So do it properly, register it with the XML catalog. There's a little bit of magic involved in registering with the XML catalog, but the important point here is the install data local target, which is about two-thirds of the way down the screen there. Again, for want of a pointer, but I guess you can see it. The dash local hooks are run, again, as part of install data. It is guaranteed to run install data local after it has run install data. It's the very last thing it does, is run this local rule. And again, James has done the right thing and said, okay, we don't actually believe uninstall ever works, but just in case, we put uninstall local as well. If we uninstall this package, it will remove it from the catalog. I don't think, like, even make disk check doesn't actually check that make uninstall works. I think people have just lost faith that it's going to do what you want. Too many things get broken when you start uninstalling stuff that other things depend on. And finally, there is this, as he says, small hack. In recent auto make versions, when you run make disk check, it becomes very stroppy if you don't clean up after yourself. So if the make clean target doesn't actually clean up all of the files you generated, it rightfully complains that it's not so clean anymore. So by more or less trial and error, he's worked out he needs to remove a couple of these other crazy files just to make life easier for himself. And that's, again, the sort of thing you don't put it in first time. You just make your automake files, you run make disk check, make disk check complains going, oh, wait, I ran make clean and it didn't actually clean everything up. And then you poke around a bit and work out what you need to clean up. Yes, and with almost perfect timing, have about a 15, 20 minute break, come back at say 1:45, and we'll do another hour or so. It has been politely but directly pointed out to me that I'm an idiot and should have included a diagram early on of what the hell was going on here. No. You were one of only three people who mentioned it, so it's pointed. The subtlety is lost. Ah, thanks. Great. Actually, since I've discovered my mouse, I'll use that, yes. As someone just pointed out, I have a mouse pointer, so all my complaints apparently about not having a pointer were invalid. But let me just attempt to start off by drawing the 3-second picture of what we've done so far. And this really is a little bit abbreviated because if you look in, say, the AutoConf book for what happens, it takes 4 pages to do this diagram. But okay, take 2. Rusty's idea is probably a good one here of delineating between what you as the developer writes and what magic happens. So, you as the developer are responsible for writing configure.in and makefile.im. And because this is my example, it's a really simple project where you only have one level of directory hierarchy. But bear in mind, if you have multiple levels of directories, you're going to have multiple makefile.ims. But you're generally only going to have one of these. One only of these. One per directory of these. You also have elsewhere on your system various M4 files. Which we'll assume you haven't written. You've got them from the AutoConf distribution, or they come with other packages you've installed, or whatever. AC local is used to produce the aclocal.m4 file. This configure.in and makefile.am, aren't you already undoomed? This is why you don't draw diagrams. Um, or more correctly, why you draw diagrams ahead of time. Configure.in and makefile.am through the magic of AutoMake produce what's the name of that file? Problem is here. This may well be makefile.am and it gets changed again later. Configure.in and makefile.an through the magic of autoconf produces configure. Now this is sort of where there's a little bit of backwards and forwards going on here is the problem, and I'm not 100% sure which one does which. You specify which makefile.ans to produce in configure.in, but they're actually produced by AutoMake. So AutoMake runs through your makefile.am and mostly works on that, but it also has a bit of a poke around inside configure.in going, what are you going to be doing in the future? And I can use that to work out what I have to produce. And then autoconf runs through configure.in and checks, does some sanity checking on the makefile.in and produces the configure script. So you as the developer need to write this one and this one. And then run these processes in order. That's also used here. Also used by autoconf. aclocal.m4 is the collection of all of the different macros that configure.that autoconf is going to use to test your various features. There may also be some M4 macros inside configure.in, but they're obviously already being shipped with your package since you're shipping configure.in, so it doesn't need to put them in aclocal.m4. The whole reason for this file existing is, again, so that the target machine does not need to have all of the different M4 macro packages installed that you have installed. It just selects out the ones that you need and sends them off to the end user. So that can quite potentially be a large file. If you're looking, for example, the configure.in of big common package. Window managers are usually a good example. Some kind of window manager that's designed to run on multiple boxes, like a sort of Enlightenment or Sawfish or something like this. Even reasonably trivial window managers, because there's an awful lot of X settings that vary between different machines, the sort of locations that files might exist in and what libraries have what features depending on whether you've got X11, R4, R5 or R6 and so on. So that's the 5-cent diagram. And we have so far, we glossed over step one, running AC local bit. I've talked a fair bit about the AutoMake portion. So now we're on to the autoconf portion of things. There's a lie on this slide, by the way. Please ignore point three. Yes? Yes. No, you need to have the M4 processor installed. Yes. And it's not considered an onerous assumption. Like, it's considered as much of a problem for them as having, you're assuming they have a C compiler and things like that. So, and they have a shell. And so, yes, they do need to have an M4 processor installed, but a lot of systems do already. Yeah, there may well be some compatibility problems there too. Yes. Autoconf, automake, and autoconf do not assume GNU make. They write make files that allegedly run on different sorts of make. They actually test these on various other systems. So again, that's sort of one of the reasons why the make files tend to be a bit verbose. They can't use some of the, there's some sort of handy features in GNU make as far as variable manipulation and stuff go that they can't assume. It really does look torturous if you read a lot of what's going on under the covers here, because the main goal is it's highly portable code. And it's also, I think, no one dares touch it because they're not really sure if some particular line of code is required for portability on a platform they've all forgotten about. So it sort of accretes rather than gets developed. So autoconf is parsing the various configuration options, like minus minus prefix or minus minus disable super fast speed or whatever. Checks for various files, functions, libraries, compiler flags required, whatnot. Ignore the next one, it's a lie. It does some sanity checking on the makefile.in, and it's used by automake. Automake looks in configure.in to work out what makefile.ins to create, but autoconf has no part in creating them. And one bit I did leave out of this diagram. Auto header creates a file typically called config.h.in. And autoconf, config.h.in is essentially a template file. Autoheader ran through your config.in, looked at all of the tests you're going to make when you get to the autoconf section of the world, and created a template saying, here are the sort of prototype hash define statements you're going to need. And we'll see an example of this in a minute. Config.in then does, or autoconf does all of the testing and defines all of the ones you actually have to one. So I'll show you an example in a minute, if that's not too clear what's going on. Okay, starting at the beginning this time. So it's guaranteed one way people would understand me, whether I start in the middle or the beginning. Your general config.in file is pretty boilerplate at the beginning and the end. We have a bunch of sort of initialize the package I'm doing, in this case some sort of crazy package called Slice and Dice, version 0.1. And there's a comma missing in the first line. The next line, any macro here, any line starting AC underscore is an autoconf macro, or autoconf function if you like. Anything starting AM underscore is an automake macro. It is possible to use autoconf without using automake. Can't quite use automake very well without autoconf, but it is possible just to generate the makefile.in files yourself by hand and then use autoconf, like essentially skip the step labeled 2 up there and you just do the makefile.in yourself. Not a particularly common method, but is sometimes used for packages that are designed to run both on Unix systems and on Win32 systems. I'm not sure, I don't do any packaging that has to run across such different architectures, but a few people I know who do that tend to actually check their makefile.ins in and don't auto-generate them on the Windows platforms. So I assume there's some issues there running under DJ GCC and things like that. The next line, the AM config header, just says create this config.h.in thing. The alternative is if you don't create that, all of the things that would normally end up in that file, which are just it's purely a C-specific thing, they're just hashifying commands, would end up on the command line as minus capital D thing, like minus capital D have set env or something like that. Not too bad, it starts to look like a kernel build after a while because your GCC lines are sort of about this long on the screen, not particularly easy to debug, so putting them in config.h is sort of good form. Next line just says, I'm using AutoMake. What actually happens here is when you run AutoMake, it literally runs through this file going, is there any line where the first non-white space character is AM underscore? If it is, that's a macro I'm interested in. Oh look, there's one that says init AutoMake, so they're going to be using AutoMake at some point. And then it actually has to run around and go, oh, there's these special variables, package name and package version, which were initialized earlier on. And so AutoMake has to do a little bit of parsing of the AC things to find out what the name and version of the package are. In this case, name is slice and dice and version is 0.1. It uses that when it's creating, for example, in the make dist rule, it will then create a tarball called slice and dice dash 0.1.tar.gz. So that's why it needs to know that information. The next sort of sections, the four comments I put in are just a rough order in which things tend to happen in a autoconf style file. Check for various programs that we need. In this case, life's going to be pretty doomed if you don't have a C compiler. We need libtool, we need intel tool. It may be you don't need a C compiler, for example. You might be just packaging up a documentation package or something. That doesn't stop people cutting and pasting in your C documentation packages that check for a C compiler. It's not strictly required. Then you often will check for particular libraries being present on the system that you're going to link against. That those tests, as we'll see later, may require testing what system you're on. AutoConf runs, if you ever look at a tarball, there's often a file in there called config.geth, which is a script that contains the sort of acquired knowledge of all the various systems things might run on, and it tries to work out, what am I? You can override this by passing in minus minus host and minus minus target if you're trying to cross-compile, saying, well, I am an I386, but I'm actually trying to build for a Sun, and it will obey the rules. Or you can, but on the whole, it will just work out that, okay, in this case, I'm a I386 unknown Linux. And you might say, well, okay, I'm on a Linux box in this case. I don't need to include libIEEE or something for floating point. I'm on a Sun, I do. I'm on HPUX, God knows. And if you're writing these, well, if you're me and you're writing these, you go, wait, I'm on Linux. It's all pretty easy. I just do the minimum. Maybe because I've screwed this up before, I'll put in a few that I know are required on Solaris. Then you tend to release it and you just wait for the complaints to come in about how it doesn't build on alphas or whatever. And usually people who tend to send these things in will actually say, what I needed to link this library, and so then you put a test, okay, if I'm on Bob's own OS, then I need to link in libfoo or something. Check for various header files that you might want. Again, this is often a multiple choice question. You may have sort of, on one box, it may be called foo.h, on another box it may be sys/foo.h, on another box it may be bar.h or something. So you'll often just check, do I have this? If not, do I have this? If not, do I have this? I got both of them, what's going on? And that's no joke. There's systems that have where for some particular file A and some particular file B, and then the next test is make sure I've only got one of these. If I've got both of them, I'm on a different system and I actually need file C. Such is the joy of naming conventions and having so many standards to choose from. Everyone picks a different one. Then, and in no particular order, often you'll check for library functions. Okay, I've got some. Maybe I have the free type library, but what version have I got? I can't necessarily trust what it's called. People don't always version number their library binaries correctly. Does it have a particular function that I'm about to use? Often you can tell particular libraries, true type libraries and free type libraries being particular examples by what functions they contain. So you'll often see tests for, do I have some particular function? If I've got that, then, okay, I'm not version 1.0, maybe on 2 or 3, check for another function, I now know what I am. Yes? So the question is, if for version dependencies, if you want to say something like, I want version of lib2 greater than something, unfortunately, it depends, is the safest answer. That's why things like package config that I was talking about earlier have sort of come into existence, because there really is this problem of how do you ask an arbitrary library, what version are you, how compatible are you with future releases and backwards releases? So infrastructure like that exists for some packages. For a general library, you've really got to play this, poke around inside, look for a function that might be on one particular library. I maintained for a while a GNOME wrapper around RPM that every version of RPM that was released for about 7 or 8 consecutive versions was subtly backwards incompatible. And the autoconf checks for trying to work out what version of RPM you're against were terrible, because you'd be poking around going, do I have this function this time? Hey, so I've got this, okay, I'm 4.02, okay. Or I'm at least version 4.01, because he's introduced that, and then he took away this other function in 4.03, so if I've got that, I'm 4.01 or 4.02. And it's a bit of a detective game, and basically you just hope you don't ever have to work with libraries like that that are that unstable. So in short, there's no good way to check for this sort of thing. If you have absolute confidence and you're building on limited platforms where they've got the version numbering right, then you can possibly check that, just like literally check the file name. But if you're trying to write portable code across all platforms, you're doomed, because they're not always named correctly or consistently. Finally, the important thing in the configure.in is this AC output macro at the end, which lists all of the functions configure is going to create. The functions that uses to, the files, that, sorry, all of the files configure is going to create. And I'm talking about that configure is going to create, not autoconf. So when you package up your tarball and distribute it and someone's trying to build it, they run configure. At the end of it all, configure is going to create /and/dice.spec, make file, it's going to create a make file in the source directory, it's going to create a file called makefile.in in the PO directory. The files that AutoMake has created or that you've some other way created are these particular names. Oh, look, I have a pointer. With .in on the end. So our source directory may contain /and/dice.spec.in. And configure through autoconf knows that it needs to take that /and/dice.spec.in, substitute in any variables that it's worked out, things like what's my version, what's my package name, what day of the week is it, who knows what, whatever you like, and substitute that in, and then rename it to be /and/dice.spec. So again, this is where AutoMake actually looks through here and goes, I'm trying to generate something called source.makefile. That means we'll need a source.makefile.an. I don't have one of those, but I've got source/makefile.am. So I can run AutoMake on that and generate .in. So there is this sort of weird symbiosis between AutoMake and AutoConf going on here. Is that sort of clear what's going on with the generating the files at the end there? Yep. Oh, yes, okay. Why is this po/makefile.an? Get text maintainers are insane. Would be basically the PO file is the PO subdirectory is traditionally where you have the various translations. In a lot of packages, you then subsequently run another file on this po/makefile.an that actually produces the final makefile. So there is a file in PO called makefile.in.in that is then turned into makefile.in. Right? You can. It looks mad, and when you're first starting out, you always look at that and you go, there's a typo. But it's not. It's just annoying. Yes? Yes, all right. There's most of the ones on that you include in configure.in that are just macros with nothing special on the end come with autoconf, so they're documented in the autoconf info pages. Other ones that may be various third-party macros that is literally you just have to know what packages you've got installed on your system and what functionality they provide. There's one we get to that we've seen earlier, this package check that package config uses. That's a macro that comes with package config. It's documented in the package config documentation saying this is the macro, this is the MPL macro you put in your autoconf files to check for versioning on packages. So the ones that come with autoconf though, you really have to just read. There's about 4 or 5 pages in the autoconf info pages of the various functions in various levels of supported and deprecated status, because in some cases if you can sort of not use a particular macro if you know you're not going to be running on some really old systems. But if you want to be really careful, maybe you need to include these old things. Yes?
Is that some way of generating the AC output macro like that? If you have like a dozen subdirectories in two levels, all of them.
I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
If you have like a dozen subdirectories in two levels,
yes. Yes. Ah, right. Okay. So you're talking about in the AC output macro here? Yes. Okay. So the question is, if you've got truckloads of subdirectories here and all of them have makefile.ims in them or makefile.ins, do you have to list them all in AC output? Yep. It can become quite long. And it's a fairly famous, and it's a sort of a way to conditionally build part of your packages. If you're going, well, if I've got this foo directory over here, it's got all the build stuff, but it doesn't actually build at the moment. You can just leave it out of AC output and make won't descend into it. It won't build the makefile.in and stuff like that. That's one way to cut it out. Yes?
Does that mean you can have a prefix to run
the build? Well, yes, you can do that. The thing is, like in practice, you build config.in, it's a pain to do it the first time. You usually swipe it from some other project. You just edit it to match. It doesn't change that often. Like, if you think about anyone who's done sort of even fairly active development on projects, you tend not to change your major directory structure that often. You screw around a fair bit with maybe adding or deleting a C file here or there, which is one line in a makefile.am somewhere. You maybe mess around a bit in the documentation trying to get that to build, but your overall structure tends to not change. So people don't complain too much about having to list all of the things here. Yes, again? Well, send in a patch, I guess. it does. Yes, it does sound like a good idea. Yes, AutoScan does a. Does it build up a? It builds up the output list as well. Because I know it gives you a good. It gives you. The AutoScan gives you a good attempt at what to put in for various tests and stuff as well. Okay, maybe AutoScan does it. Okay. But as I said, I can. My personal thing in projects I'm involved with, you tend to not change that list too often. Although it is not an uncommon source of confusion that you do lead off one directory and spend 20 minutes wondering why the hell something isn't being built. Yeah, if I could reach the diagram. All right, leaping straight into how we do this with examples. Just my goal here is sort of to get you familiar with what these things look like so you can read other people's code and looking in the info files. I think it's a fairly scary way to learn to do autoconf is to read the GNU info files on it, because it cranks up to high speed fairly quickly and there's a lot to remember. So I prefer the show by example method here. Without too much commentary, this should be reasonably clear. AC check funcs, amazingly enough, checks for functions. In this case, it's saying, do I somewhere in standard files that I build, in this case in libc, have clearenv and setenv functions? If I do, it goes down the bottom. You've sort of got to look at the two shaded sections here in parallel. Just cross your eyes or something. The fragment down the bottom is a config.h.in fragment, something that's been generated by AutoHeader. it's a bunch of prototype hash defines that are all undefined at the moment. At the point that auto headers run, if nothing further happens, we don't have any of these functions. AC check func runs through and goes, oh, maybe I've got clear env, but I don't have set env. Be slightly mad, but anyway. It would then run down the bottom. It would then, when it's generating config.h, it would hash define have clear env to be one, and it would leave have set env alone. So later on in your code, you can just do a hash if def have clear env and do some code that uses that, and if endef have set env and do some code that uses that. This is very C specific. C++ like is specific. Not so useful if you're just doing lots of Python programming or something. But AC check headers does a sort of similar thing. Do I have this DLSCF fcn.h header somewhere in my standard include paths? Maybe earlier I've screwed around a bit with the include paths to get it to poke about in random other places. Yes? If it found it in a non-standard directory, that means that earlier in config.h, you'd actually added something to the C flags to tell it to look in the non-standard directory, right? It doesn't run through every possible directory on your system looking for header files. It goes. It runs through, okay, your compiler has a bunch of standard directories it runs through in a standard order, right? Like it looks in user include, then it might look in subdirectories of user include. It stops at the first one it finds. If earlier on you've told, at that point it just says, I've got it somewhere, you've told me either in my standard path or you've adjusted my C flags to add extra places for me to search, somewhere in there I've found socket.h. And so it's sort of up to you to order your include files. If it's important that you find socket.h before sys/socket.h, you better be searching user include before you search user include sys. Yeah, well in like you get the system ones for free, you know, which you can find out from, what is it, GCC minus V or something, just or somehow find out the include path. But if you're adding extra things to the C flags, like you might be saying, okay, and I also want you to consider /opt/dev/include, I may have set that up earlier. It's up to you at that point not to start removing files from the C flags, not to start removing include paths once you've found a particular header, because you don't know where it's found it. So you might say, well, I've added opt/foo/include to my C flags. It finds socket.h. I then remove it all through your code. It happily thinks it can find socket.h and things will explode later. Check funcs. I guess what I'm demonstrating here, the first check funcs just took a list of here's multiple functions to check. The second one just takes a single one. I think this might be a tragic cut and paste error, actually. I wasn't meaning to give two check funcs here. M4 is one of these languages where it's a bit, lot like Perl. It sort of makes pretty educated guesses about what you wanted to say here. It sees bind text to main code set and goes, okay, that's a word. It's also a one element list for me to run through. Whereas in the first case where you've got a couple of words there, you needed to actually tell it, he's a list. He's an atom that I want you to run through. You can set up prototypes for config.h.in. Like you can create a file called acconfig.h that has various things that are just dumped in config.in. But typically you don't do that. If you want to somehow so you're thinking of an example where, correct me if I'm wrong here, you're thinking of an example where, say, maybe I want to say if I'm going to set the foo variable and I want you to have hash define foo in there, and foo will be set based on some condition like is it an odd numbered month or something like this. Is that the sort of thing you're asking about? Oh, okay. See, if they don't pass in minus minus, I've read the documentation, it's not going to build. That's not completely crazy, right? I'd like to point out there's quite a few programs out there with config files, particularly, that won't run unless you read the documentation and change some critical parameter. The sort of the I've read the docs thing. In that case, I would do it in my config.in file. I would say there's a particular parameter that isn't going to show up in the minus minus help listing of configure, or maybe it is, and by default it's off. And if they don't turn it on, it's not going to build. So in that case, you would just have by default it's off, so it's going to appear in AC configures undefed, and if they turn it on, it'll be hash defined and everything will be happy. You can also do it, if we just go back here a bit, to a sort of standard config.in, you can also do things like this, and it's not completely crazy. You just test, is some particular, did they pass in minus minus enable red docs? If they didn't pass that in, you call the AC error macro, which simply dumps out an error message and stops the configure at that point. Read the docs, you bozo. You can send back whatever message you want. Like, AutoConf has macros AC error, AC warn, AC message that are various levels of severity, AC debug, for printing out messages. Because if you think, when you're running configure, what do you see on the screen? You tend to see checking for libdb1, yes. Checking for libfoo, no. Checking for fridge, yes. Checking for path to docbook, user share local, whatever. All of that is a particular one of these AC check macros, like AC check something prints out checking for, seeing it's checking for, and then yes or no at the end. Checking for a particular path to a function will print the path at the end. You can design your own things that say, okay, I'm checking for whether you've paid your credit card bill or something, and then at the end, no, and here's the amount outstanding. You can do quite a lot of stuff like that. Yes? Yes. We get to that on the next page, maybe? Yes, we get to that on the next page, conveniently enough. In the second example. So just a couple of minutes and we'll get there. These are slightly more complicated examples. Just wondering if I can make it a little bit bigger, still fit, yes. Okay. The first one is, it's sort of what you were asking before, actually. It's saying, I want to have this variable have CDDA. Initially set it to false. Then check in the headers to see if I have CDDA interface and CDDParanoia.h. If I do, which is what comes next, a lot of these, again, these M4 macros, they take variable number of arguments, you just leave off the ones you're not really interested in. And things like check headers takes, check for these headers, if you find them, do this, if you don't find them, do this, maybe by default do this. Here's a help string in some cases. In this case, it's saying check for these two header files, check for CDD interface, check for CDD paranoia. If you find them, set CDDA libs to be these two things, which look like flags that are going to be passed to the linker later on. And set have CDDA to true, which will then poke around in acconfig.h.in and set that hash defined to 1. So at that point, your program knows that you've got the things. You've also set up the particular flags that you can pass to the linker when you're building stuff. In a minute, we'll see how something like CDDA libs there actually gets put into the makefile. The second example is the question you were asking a minute ago up the back there. It's checking for, do I have the function JPEG start decompress in the JPEG library? Sort of one way to check for a particular version. Maybe an early version of libjpeg didn't have this function, or some particular proprietary version might not have this function, others do. Check for this function. If you find it, check to see if we have jpeg lib.h. Again, we may have a system where libjpeg is installed. It's quite happily the correct version of the library, but unfortunately you don't have the header files because you only installed the executable version library, didn't install the development packages. So in this case, if we found the function, check to see if jpeglib is there, and set jpeg ok to yes. Otherwise, jpeg ok is no. If we don't have the function, so we're down to the AC message warn, print out some kind of scary looking message. The minus LM on the end of that AC message warn line is, if you track back through all the parentheses, belongs to the AC check lib macro. That's saying, in order to check, what configure does is it builds little test programs all the time. If you ever look through config.log after you run configure and something's failed, there's a little C program that's exploded for some reason. And what this is saying is, in order to build a little C program, and what it really does is it just goes in the main function, it just tries to run this JPEG start decompress. And when it builds it, it links it against libjpg. This tells it you also need to link against the math library, LM. Yes? Yes.
If you check the game.so, that actually comes from the null package usually where it shows up two numbers in the actual library, right?
Yeah, okay, so which one does it link against when you go minus L JPEG? libjpg.so, doesn't it? Yeah, okay. There may be, what you're saying sounds correct, sort of rings and bells. Yes? Right. Well, there's sort of two different problems, like Mark's talking about. Why bother checking against the header if you can already link against the thing? Then again, bear in mind this is meant to work across umpteen different platforms and architectures here. So the fact that tests like this exist probably means that there's some platform where that isn't a valid argument. It's also, in a way, sanity checking. Like, some bozo could have gone through and just deleted your header file, and you still have the library floating around. Yeah, you don't necessarily have the .h file in all cases if you're like dynamically opening a library, for example. Although that's not the case. This more complicated example I ripped out of. What did I rip it out of? Some big scary package that I had on my system. No. Might have been something like Image Magic or something, actually. It was, or the GIMP. It was like, I've ripped out something where if they're testing for JPEG this way, there's a platform it doesn't work on if you take shortcuts. It's been used on enough. And again, we see here, okay, after setting this various JPEG OK, yes or no, they test to see, well, if it's yes, here's how we need to link against it and define the have libjpg, otherwise complain viciously. It only warns, too. It doesn't explode, which means the program's quite happy to carry on without libjpg. Also note, again, as has been pointed out a couple of times, we're using really old-fashioned portable shell here. Born shell is the requirement. So there's no putting things in square brackets to test them. You have to use the test function. You can't assume... Well, there's a little assumption in there, actually. You can't assume things like comparing against if a variable is empty, comparing against it is not necessarily always a good idea. So they tend to prefix it with X or something like that. So you tend to test if X JPEG OK is equal to X, would mean JPEG OK is empty. In this case, I believe earlier on they actually said JPEG OK is always defined. It'll be yes or no based on earlier tests. Yes? Ah, yes, okay, it'll be treated as a flag to the test. When it, that's right.
then you've got an equal time. Yeah. So people over here may not have heard that. Rusty's been programming longer than us. And if JPEG OK, for example, was the string minus A, bearing in mind the way shell substitutions work before things are executed, this would work out as if test minus A equals, and it would treat the minus A as an argument to the test function, then things would all go wahoo knee shaped fairly quickly. This is, again, you sort of read things like, if you're going to get into this, I recommend buying the Goat book, the AutoComp AutoMake LibTool book from New Riders, which has a couple of chapters on how to write really insanely portable shell. You could also read a document I've got in the GNOME CVS repository, but you don't have to spend as much money for that, so you might not treat it so credibly. And also, it's only available in the CVS. I haven't put it on the web yet, so sort of another minus. The other thing that people tend to do with configure, and this is the one that, like all the checking for various libraries and checking for header function stuff, that all just happens magically, really. If you've got a vaguely sane system, you run /configure and it just goes chug, 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 right, you're ready to run late. People want to use configure to customize things because they don't want the same Linux installation as the guy next door to them. So it needs to be able to pass things like, where do I install things? If you, by default, if you just set up a really simple configure.in that does nothing, except maybe has an AC output line at the end to generate a couple of make files, and you go /configure --help, you get a screen full of help. You didn't put any of that in there. It just, you get it for free. You get to set the prefix. You get to set the include dir, the exec prefix, the old include dir, the shared state dir, all these sort of stuff. And if you don't want to set them, they're just all happily nice defaults. But you get that for free. You get things like program name transform, --, program name transform, --, program name suffix, program name prefix. Mostly useful if you're parallel installing something and you don't want it to be called GCC, you want it actually to be called GCC-IX86 or something. You can say every time you install a program in this particular build, add IX86 onto the end. Or program name transform is a much more complex thing where you actually pass it a regular expression. Well, I think you pass it a sed script, but it runs on every program name, which means you can pick out particular program names to transform and not others. It's not neat, it's not particularly easy, but if you have to do it, the functionality is there. Most people don't use it. The sort of people who are famous for using this are those who tend to try and build cross-compilers and parallel install different versions of libraries and stuff like that. You don't want to have name clashes. You get that for free, is my point here. You get host and target platform specification for free, again, if you're cross-compiling. As I said, config.get, which is called by AutoConf, makes a very good attempt at trying to work out what platform you're on. If you're on an x86 trying to build for a Sun, it's not no good if it actually tries to build for an x86, so you sometimes need to tell it. You get that for free. However, it's never enough. You want to be able to add your own customizations ultimately. Things like, do I build the documentation or not? Again, a fairly common one with my experience in GNOME. Everyone has trouble setting up the documentation building stuff in GNOME. So we've gone to the point of, particularly for the API documentation, so we build it for you in the distributed tarballs, and by default, when you run configure, it doesn't rebuild it because we just don't have enough hours in the day to handle all the bug reports. Owen Taylor, the guy who maintains GTK, felt that his bug reporting load went down by about half when he stopped asking people to rebuild the documentation all the time. And in fact, this is his code I swiped. Couple of things here, just to give you an idea of the sort of things you can do and how relatively simple it is to do it. The first example adds an argument --, with HTML dir equals something, which in GTK and various other programs is used to say, here's where I want you to install the API documentation, and here's where I've installed other API documentation that you're going to make links to. The documentation building code uses that path when it's creating various links within itself. So we have a little help string there. And that AC argwith macro by itself just happily, if you pass it in, it sets the with HTML dir variable, with underscore HTML underscore dir variable, to be whatever value you passed in. If you didn't pass in anything, it just sets it to be the empty string. So then you can happily go through testing whether it's the empty string or whatever they've made it, and work out whether you need to do something with it. On the next line, we see an example of this, complete with X, to avoid problems where HTML dir might be minus F or something. Yes? Is there support for what, sorry? Yes, you know, you can do default arguments. Well, in the AC argwith, we've got a case immediately, like the next few lines of code are actually showing what to do. If they haven't set with HTML dir, we set it to be data dir slash dpk doc slash HTML. If they have set it, we set it to be whatever, we set our capital HTML dir variable, which later on we're going to substitute into our makefile.ins, to be this. Bearing in mind, all of these little code fragments are, autoconf turns them into slightly larger code fragments that it then puts into the configure script. So none of this code is actually executed when autoconf is run. It's just used to be turned into a big mess of shell that then is run when you run configure. Oh no, if you make a mistake here, you don't find out for hours. Yeah, it's great. You've forgotten what you changed. I must admit, playing with autoconf in order to make you tend to just make every few minutes when you're bored, just run autogen again to make sure nothing exploded. And for big packages, it's a pain, because if it takes an hour to build, it's annoying. The next example shows a different sort of fairly common argument style of minus minus enable something or disable something, where here enable and disable for some reason come built in with defaults. In this case we're saying, okay, you can go minus minus enable dtk doc, here's the help string. The enable GTK doc variable is set to yes or no, for historical reasons. I don't know why they didn't choose enable and disable, but they've chosen yes or no. With and without are typically, you're going with foo equals, you're passing in some value. Enable, disable are Boolean things, they're either on or off. I think you can go with, if you go with something and you don't pass in an equals, I think you get yes or true as the value. Yeah. But essentially enable and disable are used when it's an on-off style function. Yeah, and there's something, and I think if you go like with HTML dir and you don't pass in something, it will treat it as yes, and without, it treats it with no. And in this case, yes, no, and auto are the possible values. By default, it sets it to auto, which is slightly poor programming practice because you're left scratching your head wondering what the hell does auto, does it mean yes or no or whatever? Yes? Ah, sorry. Feel free to sing out. Yes. ACARG enable means you can go minus minus, disable equals minus. It actually, yeah, with and without. If you go dot slash configure minus minus help, it always goes, there are various with features, and you can go with GTK doc equals no is the same as without GTK doc. It's a fairly convenient built-in feature, even though in that case it's longer to type without. And here again, we looking further into code, you see that if enable GTK doc is auto, then that turns out to be the same as no unless the GTK doc variable is set. The reason for this sort of doubled layer magic there is the GTK doc variable gets set a bit earlier, so that when you're building this check, it always builds the documentation again. this fragment. Earlier on, I showed you a fragment where a similar sort of thing was happening with AutoMake 1.6. This is code that works in AutoMake 1.4, and so there's a bit more jumping through hoops. Finally, we get to the bit in the diagram where it puts things together. Here's how AutoMake and AutoConf interact. You make decisions in your configure.in file, or actually ultimately in your configure script. You want them to be substituted into your makefile.in, because remember, AutoMake's run through made a makefile.in that has various, it's a template, it's got various holes where you're going to fill in things later based on decisions that configure makes. What happens is you call the AC subs variable. AC subs says for every single file in my AC output list, which is all those makefiles, PO slash makefile, for slash makefile, etc., anywhere in this case the HTML underscore variable exists, replace it with slash temp slash HTML. So HTMLDIR, in all capitals there, has the same meaning throughout all of your files that AutoConf is going to play with. This is actually very useful. It means you can define something like, well, we saw in the prototype configure.in, it always defines package name and version. So wherever you want to put the package name or wherever you want to put the I am version 0.6 in your code, you can just put the code in the make file or in the code as ampersand name a variable ampersand. That's the pattern it's looking to match. Sorry, at sign. Yeah, I always muddle it up. Shift 2 on some keyboards. That's the pattern it's trying to match. At sign, variable name, at sign, on the grounds that you don't tend to use that much in normal everyday programming. And so it can look through any files you like. Like you can even put in the AC output, you can say, I want to have main.c that you generate from main.c.in, and if I have package name in there somewhere, it substitutes it in. Although typically you don't do that. What you do is you, in your make file, you define if you want to put the package name, say, in your code, you have your makefile or your config.h define package name being this particular string, slice and dice, and then in your main.c you just use that package name variable because it's been defined at the C level. And as it says here, if the variable you've gone AC subs is empty, it just removes that variable from the template. This is very good for conditional code because you can sort of, the thing you're substituting in can be quite a complex construction, and if you're just not interested, it's just empty and it just disappears. Close to the end now. Cool. So here's an example of what's going on in practice, and also an example of the package check things going on. Package check modules, which is an M4 macro that comes with a package check application, you pass it in the name of a variable, that's your variable. In this case, again, I've stolen code from libglade, so it's passing in libglade as a variable. Libglade is saying, I want version 2.4.10 or later of libxml2, I want version 1.0.0 of HTK, and 2.0.0 of GDK2, or later. Package can check modules as all sorts of voodoo, and looking up the .pc files works out that you've got those versions of everything. It looks in all of those files, they list what C flags they need to build with those files, merges all of them together, gets rid of duplicates, merges together the various things on the link line, can't reorder things there because on some platforms the order things appear to the linker are important. This leads to some insanity where you might have like minus LM appearing 27 times in certain linking things. LibTool has a cool bug like that. It then, package check modules then creates two variables based on the name of the thing you passed in. One underscore C flags and one underscore libs. And so the next two lines here say substitute those in to all my files in AC output. In one particular makefile we may have saying, okay, I want you to set the includes flag to the contents of the C flags, and so that gets substituted, and I want you to set the LDAdd flag that you use when building libglade to the contents of libblade LDF, libs, sorry. And again, that's not actually the way it's written in the makefile, because James Hensley loves his bleeding edge code. In particularly recent AutoMakes, every single file, this is even true in AutoMake 1.4, every single variable that Configure wants to substitute into your template, it makes a special variable for in the makefile. So there'll always be a line, if I'm substituting in, if I've got AC subs foo in my configure file, there will be in my makefile, it will have foo equals, and whatever the contents of foo was at the time it was substituted in. This is in the final makefile that Configure has generated. It can be useful for debugging, because you can just echo it out. It also just means that in your makefiles, you can put much more natural looking constructs like this. This is using makefile level variables, whereas this is using autoconf level pattern substitution. So in some ways, this last way is a bit more natural looking if you're used to makefiles. On the other hand, I kind of prefer the first one because it pretty much screams at you, this is something that autoconf is going to touch. So if you want to know what's going on here, look in configure.in. The second one, you've got to sort of screw around a bit and wonder who's sending that variable. Yes?
The second one has an advantage if you're hacking in the main file afterwards.
Yes, yes. If you, again, for debugging, if you decide don't want to keep going back to square one, I just want to screw around with the makefile a bit, the second one is much useful. The only drawback, as I said, the makefile that gets generated by AutoMake is huge, because it's got one of these variables for every single thing you substitute in configure.in. It's got all these targets you've never heard of before. So if you really want to hack around at that makefile level, write your own makefile from scratch. It's smaller. Yes. 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 Bit of a space saving too. But I'm just pointing out, there's a couple of ways to do this. Brief, somewhat cautious tale about third-party macros. In general, they get dumped in some standard directories that your AutoMake and AutoConf builds know where to look. Because remember, both AutoMake and AutoConf use these macros. User share AC local is fairly common. User share AutoMake for the AutoMake ones. But there may be other directories which you can control by setting the AC local flags environment variable that's in the AutoMake and AutoConf manual page. You can also pass in AC flags to the build process, which adds them. But generally, if you've installed these M4 macros in some non-standard directory, you knew what you were doing when you installed them, and so you know how to suck them out again in your build process. And it is useful if you're doing parallel builds of things, because you might want to put the new versions over there and only use them when you really, really want to. AutoMake is a bit broken, and AutoConf are a bit broken. If they see duplicate macros, if they see like you've defined package check macro in two different directories, it complains. Some versions have actually halted, in other versions it just carries on with one of them. It would be nice if it sort of went, well, I'm not going to complain because they're obviously just identical. But it doesn't do that check, unfortunately. So you can get warnings without trying. And as I said earlier, AC local is responsible for sucking all of those bits out. This is sort of the continuation of let's work backwards. We're at the very beginning here. AC local sucks everything out of the third party things, puts them into aclocal.m4 for you to use in your configure script. This is purely space filler, just to show you the sort of hoops you have to jump through to write macros. This is one, the JH is James Hensley's here. For a long time, various distributions had older versions of Python on it, and he needed Python 2 for various things. And then things like Red Hat started shipping Python 2, but they called it Python 2 instead of Python, whereas if you built it from source, it was called Python. And so he had to do checking to find out what version of Python do you have and what have you called it. So going through this line by line is not particularly useful. except just to give you a brief overview, certain amount of setting up going on at the start here. If for some reason the Python variable is already set, then we're done. Like it could be you pass in a with Python path equals something back in configure. Otherwise, we need to check for things. DNL is yes, commenting. But I'm trying to think what the acronym expands to. Delete to a new line. Yes, so delete to next line or something. Basically, ignore everything up to the on the rest of that line. So choose for commenting. Here comes is a small script in Python just to check what's going on. And then there's a certain amount of screwing around, and I've dot 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 because it goes on for months, trying to work out what version of Python do you have. Because the problem here is you could have a binary called Python, you could also have a binary called Python 2, and they could be different versions of Python. And it could well be that the way your path is set up, Python 2 checks, but Python 2 gets called before Python or something. But essentially for each of these attempts at a name, it runs that little script to check, is it a recent enough version of Python? And that's the sort of text that will go into an M4 file that will be distributed with, say, libglade. Like, libglade in this case comes with its own M4 macros, one of which is this one. And then at some point in these configure scripts, he checks for JH Python check 2.0 or something to see, do I have at least version 2.0 of Python? So it's a weird combination of M4, shell, and in this case Python as well. Fairly brain-twisting. Okay, I've almost timed it well. As I said, I'm not quite sure where I'm putting up the slides at the moment, because just negotiating a web account with someone, but at some point I'll post on that site where I post the slides. So there's a double indirection going on. Alternatively, just call me late tomorrow or Friday to find out which slide I eventually put them up. And it depends on how fast a particular name server refreshes. If you want a copy of the slides or in PDF format, maybe useful. The diagram you'll have to copy yourself, for better or worse. Any questions? Further questions? Yes? No, by all means, ask away anyway. Didn't really, but since you bring it up, if you run configure scripts, you will often notice, and then if you run it and then you run it again, you'll see it'll often go creating config.cache, doing a certain text and retrieving the value, yes, cached. And it actually has this ability to record the results that it's already run through. And you see this actually, oops, oh, bother. Stupid bug, sorry. We see this here where this particular line of code here, he's setting it up to say, okay, in the cache, dump the results of this test. So if I need it later, you don't have to re-perform the test. Because some of these tests potentially could be quite long, particularly if you're having to rebuild C code all the time. Now, the bit where you're hinting at tripping people up is, I guess, where you change something and it retrieves the cache value instead of redoing the test. You installed the library, failed at exactly the same point. Yes, and there's the problem. It doesn't, when you run it again, it runs through the cache and goes, oh wait, I've already got this value, you failed this test already. The solution there is usually just to remove config.cache and get it to run again. But you're right, if you're seeing a lot of cached responses coming up in your configure script, and then you fix something that there's no possible way for your source code to know about, you basically have to force it to regenerate all the tests. well, make this clean will remove those files, but it might remove some other stuff. Because it is, for example, possible to run configure when you've already partially built the package and get the benefits of that rebuild, whereas make this clean will tend to nuke all those files. So. Test it again. It's not. In theory, that's possible, but you occasionally, and more often than you suspect, get cases where first time it tests it, it's not fatal, and later, because it's tested in some sub-package where it goes, okay, I can work around you not having JPEG, libjpeg. Later on it goes, oh wait, you really, really need libjpeg this time, so I'm failing. But the first time it would have been wrong to error out, and so using the case value there is correct. And it's one of the rough edges of the system. If it errors out, delete config.cache and run it again. But is not unusual, unfortunately. And you're right, it is a bit confusing because you spend a while wondering what on earth's going, what do I have to do to convince it to test this thing again? Other questions? So hopefully people can at least come away with this if you were terrified of AutoConf and AutoMake before, and I haven't turned you off even more. You can at least look at these scripts and have an idea of here's what's going on and experiment with them yourself. It's not too hard to simple make files to generate the AutoMake file, generate the boilerplate config, and then just go for it from there and gradually make it more and more complex. And always look at other people's packages. There's a huge amount of leveraging other work to try and do things in this field. One final thing is they're about to say, don't forget to fill out the surveys. Say, don't bring this guy back again, and put them in the box over there. Oh, but then I have to stand up for more time. For those who can't get enough of my speaking style, I'm speaking on Thursday as well, but something completely different.